I can see my notes more clearly with my glasses off, so you're going to have to be a blur as far as the weekend is concerned. Okay. The topic for the weekend is the Noble Eightfold Path. Let's get everybody settled down. Wait for everybody to get settled down. The Noble Eightfold Path was the Buddha's first teaching and his last teaching. When he first taught the five brethren, this is the topic he started out with. And the very last person to see him before he died, a wanderer named Subhadda, this is the teaching that the Buddha gave to him as well. And so provides the framework for everything else, and not only in terms of the temporal framework, but also in terms just basically the, what you might call the logical framework. If you want to understand the meaning of any of his other teachings, you have to ask yourself, well, where does this fit into the Noble Eightfold Path? And that gives you a sense of context. In the first teaching, the Buddha described the Noble Eightfold Path as a middle way composed of eight right factors that lead to the end of suffering and lead to nirvana. In his last teaching, he basically said, if you want to find a path in which people get awakened, there's only one path, and that's the Eightfold Path. And so that those two frameworks that provide even a framework for the framework. So it's interesting to look at some of the implications of these statements. First, the implication of the path as a framework for the teaching. There's a passage in Majjhima 12 where the Buddha describes people as being on various paths, going different places in their lives. And so already, willy-nilly, we're on a path of some sort. And the question is, do you know which path you're going on? He says some paths lead to a cesspool. Other paths lead to a pit of burning embers. Some paths lead to trees with meager shade, other paths lead to trees with lots of shade. And the best path, the Eightfold Path, leads to a path that leads to trees with lots of shade right next to a lake where you can bathe. So the path, the cesspool, of course, stands for the animal realm. Pit of burning embers stands for, what was it, hell. The tree with very little shade, those are the hungry ghosts. The trees with better shade, that's the human realm. The trees with even more shade, the Deva realm, and the trees with the lake, that's the nirvana. So we're already willy-nilly on a path of some kind because our actions lead someplace. Often there are results that we don't anticipate. People going to the cesspool are not planning to go to the cesspool. So what the Buddha is trying to do is to provide people with a path, a map to these paths, so they can know where these various paths lead and they can make their choice as to which path they want to follow. Now the map is actually part of the path. That's the factor called right view. It sets out this is what you do in order to get to a desirable goal. And as with any map, it provides you with not too much information, just enough to orient you and to keep you on the path. And we have to learn how to, so in this case, not the Buddha doesn't describe everything in reality in this path. There's lots of questions that he never answered. You probably know the list. If you know, is the world eternal? Is the world not eternal? Is it finite? Is it infinite? Are you the same thing as your body, or are you something separate from your body? What happens to an awakened person after they die? Those questions the Buddha said, put aside. Even the question is, do you have a self? Do you not have a self? Put aside. So there's going to be a lot of stuff that is not placed on the map. And as with any map, you don't want too much information. Like, think about a fire escape from a hotel. If they handed you the full plans to the hotel instead of showing the map to the fire escape, it would be pretty useless. When I was back in New York last year, someone said that, you know, there cannot be any one right version of the Dharma because everything is like a map. And as we all know, every map distorts. Well, the issue is some maps distort more than others. And it's pretty universal. You go around the world and you go into a hotel and they have a little diagram on the back of the door as a fire escape. And it's a pretty universal language. And then the question only is, you know, is this a genuine map or is this somebody's joke? Right, that they're putting a map up there that's going to lead you down to a burning corridor or to a door that opens up to, you know, a 50-foot drop. So there are such things as accurate maps and maps that are not so accurate for your purpose. Just as a fire escape map has a specific purpose. It's not there to tell you everything about the hotel, but it tells you what you need to know to get out. In the same way, the Eightfold Path gives you enough information to know how to get out of suffering. Also think about the proper use of a map. You follow it. It's not just to memorize and leave it at that, and it's not to argue over. I mean, you check it against reality to see if it actually corresponds to what actually works. But once you realize, okay, the map is accurate, then you realize, okay, this is a means to an end. So we're not trying to arrive at any of the factors of the path as the goal. Sometimes you hear the statement that we're trying to arrive at right view or trying to arrive at right mindfulness. These are not the goals. These are actually part of the path. And we'll talk about that later, the implications of how these function as a means to an end, but they're not the end themselves. In the case of right view, or the map that the Buddha provides, he has to provide an explanation of action and cause and effect, and how far those effects can go, because after all, he is explaining a path of action that leads to the end of suffering. So he's going to explain what are human beings capable of, what is the principle of causality that operates in such a way that you can do things that lead to an unfabricated goal without getting in the way of the goal. So that much he has to cover. This is why when he talks about mundane right view, it has to cover the issues of karma and rebirth. And when he talks about noble right view, it has to talk about causality. What are the basic principles of causality that are functioning in the way you act and the way that your actions shape your life? The map also has to give an explanation. Why bother? You know, why do you want to go to the end of suffering? Why would that be a good thing? And also what it means to do that. It talks about the dangers you have to avoid and talks about some of the areas that might seem a little risky, but you actually have to go there. You will have to explain the fabricated nature of experience, how you put things together in your experience. And the Buddhist point of view, the mind is not passive. It's not like we're just on the receiving end of input all the time. We're actually going out, placing our interpretations on things, dealing with potentials that are out there and also within us, and we actualize those potentials through our intentions. So the mind has an active role in what it's doing, in its engagement with the senses. The Buddha defines the problem of suffering in terms of clinging. We'll be going through the details a little bit later, but he talks about different things that carry suffering with them. He gives the kind of explanation that Plato would have hated. And Plato and Socrates always said, if you're going to define something, define the essence. The Buddha very rarely defines essences. When he talks about suffering, he'll give you examples so that you know he's talking about something you're familiar with. He talks about the suffering of birth, aging, illness, and death. We've been through those things, and we know that it is suffering. He talks about the suffering of having to stay with what you don't like, having to be separated from what you do like, not getting what you want. And then he summarizes it all with the five clinging aggregates. And this is where the analysis gets a little bit outside of our realm of direct experience. Although it turns out what he's describing is something very directly part of our experience. The suffering, he says, is in the clinging. Then the word for clinging also means to feed. We feed off of various activities, which he calls the aggregates. Just go down the list again for you. There's the aggregate of form, there's feeling, which is feeling tones of pleasure, pain, neither pleasure nor pain. Form is could be the form of your body, can also be physical forms of anything out there. Perception, which are the labels you apply to things. You know, gray, ceiling, orange. I'm thinking time, I'm playing a time. speakers. That's the problem with perception, especially as you get older. They get all mixed up. But those are perceptions. So then there's fabrications, which is the mind's putting things together through its intentions. And then there's consciousness, which is your awareness at the senses. And we cling to these things. We feed off of them. In fact, there's actually a double level of feeding. Because if you look at those five activities, then even form, the Buddha concludes, regards as a kind of activity, because you are consciously re-establishing your sense of your form of the body all the time. It's an intentional action. There was a science fiction story I read years back when I was a kid. It was about a teleportation device that they were working on, teleporting animals back and forth between Earth and Moon. And the reason it was animals was because they hadn't quite got it down yet. And the problem was that the bones came later. And so, you know, a little cat, a little bowl of cat would pour out of the machine, and then the cat had to wait until its bones came. But in the meantime, it didn't just sit there in the bowl. It would kind of create a sense of kind of a form, and it would crawl out of the bowl and hop around a little bit, and they'd find this pool of cat here and there, and then they'd have to scoop the cat back up and put it back in. But the fact that the cat was able to kind of consciously create a sense of its body, even without the bones, I think is a very good representation of, you know, how we reestablish, you know, where are my hands right now, where are my feet right now, and we have these bands of tension that connect things, different parts of the body, and that's how we create our sense of our form that we can use. Which is why when the breath gets still, you lose your sense of form. There are states of concentration where the breath falls silent, and you can begin to lose the sense of the form of the body there. That's just an aside. So you've got form, feeding as an activity, feeling as an activity, perception, fabrication, and consciousness. And the question sometimes comes up, you know, why did the Buddha choose these five? Why aren't there other activities of the mind that we could identify as things that we could also cling to? And I think it's because he noted that these five activities are basic to our feeding off of physical food and also our emotional food out in there in the world. Like with physical food, form, you've got the body that you've got to nourish, you've got the form of the potential foods out there that you could feed on. We cling to those. Feeling, you've got the feeling of pain that comes with hunger and the satisfaction that comes when you fall. Perception, you're trying to perceive the type of hunger you're feeling. You know, this is a hunger for something sweet, something salty. Hunger for French food, hunger for Chinese food as we get more sophisticated. Fabrication is, excuse me, the other perception, of course, is what out there is edible. And this, you know, the child's first orientation to the world. You crawl across the floor, and you find something, where does it go? Right in your mouth, you know. You decide, okay, this is something I can eat or something I can't eat. So that's kind of our first perception or the first labels that we apply to the world. You know, your mother is edible in more ways than one. Then you've got fabrication, and say you've got to find the food. There's an intentional activity that goes into finding. And also, once you've got the food, then the question is, what do you do with it? If you get a raw potato just out of the ground, you can't eat it as it is. You have to do certain things with it. That's fabrication. And then finally, consciousness is the awareness that allows you to know all these things. So these are the five activities that are basic to our feeding, which is our basic relationship with the rest of the world. And on top of that, we cling to these activities. You know, you see any personal ads, you know, people basically talking about how they like to feed. And if you like to feed the way I like to feed, maybe we can get together, you know. So these are our basic relationship with the world. But the problem is, and we define ourselves around that. And the Buddha's coming and saying, well, this is why we suffer. We cling to these activities. There's a double layer of feeding that's going on, and we're clinging to these activities. And in the clinging, we suffer. So this is why the Buddha's message is a little bit, you know, counterintuitive and goes against the grain. But when people decide they've had enough of suffering in the world, they say, well, let's give it a try. That's kind of the beginning, when you can begin to get on the path. And it's also important to notice here that the act of clinging in and of itself is suffering. Sometimes you hear that you cling to things that are impermanent, you're going to suffer, with the implication being if you can find something permanent to cling to, it's okay. But even that is going to involve suffering. It's because you're creating a sense of identity which then has to be maintained around this activity of clinging. So this is the issue we're going to be getting at. So when the Buddha is talking about the end of suffering, he's basically, this is the path to the end of clinging, this feeding activity that we have all the time. The Buddha also said in his first sermon that this is a path leading to nibbana. The word nibbana was a word that they used to describe the extinguishing of a fire back in those days. And to understand it, you have to understand how they viewed the workings of fire. Basically, as they saw it, when a fire was ignited, there was a fire element already there in the object, already there in the air. And in igniting it, you provoke it. And getting it provoked, it's going to cling to that particular piece of fuel, and then the fire burns. And as long as it's clinging, it will burn. But it's also, as it's clinging to the fuel, it is also trapped by the fuel. When they say that the fire went out, it's actually released from the fuel. And so when the Buddha is talking about nibbana as the goal, the implication is, one, it's a state that is calmed from agitation. Two, there is no clinging and is free because there is no clinging. The implication being that it's not that the objects out there are holding on to you. You're holding on to the objects. Or as John Lee used to say, if you have a plate of rice and you don't eat the rice doesn't cry. You're the one that's stuck on the rice. So it's our clinging that has to be let go of. And so the image of the fire going out for them back then meant, okay, freedom that comes from letting go. Sounds like a Janis Joplin song, you know. So that's the meaning of unbinding. One of the strategic challenges of having a path leading to unbinding is the path itself has to be fabricated. In fact, the Buddha said the Eightfold Path is the highest form of fabrication, but it's going to lead to something unfabricated, which requires, we have to understand causality to understand why that would be possible, which is one of the functions of right view, is to explain that point. The Buddha also said that this is a noble path. This relates to two things. One is the Buddha himself talked about there's a distinction between a noble search in your life and an ignoble search. The ignoble search is when you're looking for happiness in things that can age, grow ill, and die, just like you do. A noble search is for something, searching for something that does not age, does not grow ill, and does not die. So this is a path leading to something that is undying. And the meanings of arya, which is the word noble, that's translated here, has many of the same meanings that it has in English. One, it is a preeminent path. In other words, it is the highest of all paths. Two, it is virtuous. It's going to require that you act in a very principled way as you follow this path. Three, it's deserving respect. And then four, it's a universal. And this is a meaning of arya that we don't have so much in English, unless you might think of the noble gases, which don't mix with anything. They stay the way they are. In Pali, the word noble can also mean universal. This is true everywhere, true across the board for all people. And the last point that I want to touch on from his first sermon is this, saying that it is a middle way. Now, this does not mean that he said it's a middle way between sensual indulgence and self-torture. Now, this does not mean that it's middle way between sensual, between pleasure and pain, or kind of a neutral path. It's a path in which you use pleasure and you use pain for a higher purpose. Now, the pleasure here would be the pleasure of being virtuous, the pleasure of getting the mind in concentration. The pain that you're using would be the pain of the suffering in the mind itself. And here it's important to note that the Buddha talked about suffering on two levels. There's the suffering of what we call the three characteristics, and there's the suffering of the Four Noble Truths. In the three characteristics, he's talking about anything that changes is going to have stress built into it, simply by the fact that it has to be maintained by causes. The causes are unstable, so whatever that is, whatever comes as a result, will be unstable as well. And that's universal. The suffering in the Four Noble Truths is the suffering that comes from craving, clinging, and ignorance. And that's not necessary. But it turns out that that's the suffering that weighs the mind down, and that's what the path is aimed at putting an end to. We're not going to change the fact that things out there change, but we're going to change the fact that we're no longer feeding off of them. And when we don't feed off of them, then the mind doesn't have to suffer. So we're looking at pleasure and pain in line with the principle of karma. Okay, certain pleasures come from doing unskillful things, so you should try to avoid those pleasures. Certain pains come from doing unskillful things, so you avoid those pains. And then you'll also look at the impact that they have on the mind. So you're seeing the pain and the pleasure not something as ends in themselves, but as part of a causal chain that comes from either skillful or unskillful actions and can lead to beneficial or to harmful results. And so things get sorted out in line with those principles. What the Buddha calls pleasures and pains of the flesh and pleasures and pains not of the flesh. And as he said, he doesn't deny the value of any pleasures that do not have a bad impact on the mind. He talks about the pleasures of going out in the nature, pleasures of living in a society where people are at peace and harmony, the pleasures of going off to seclusion. These are just ordinary everyday pleasures, but they're helpful for the path. Then when he talks about pleasures not of the flesh or pains not of the flesh, he's talking about, on the one hand, for the pleasure that comes from concentration practice. Now this doesn't happen willy-nilly. You have to actually give rise to this kind of pleasure. Secondly, the pain of that is not of the flesh is the pain that comes when you realize there's awakening, but I'm not there yet. And I'm going to have to do a lot of work to get there. And there's kind of a painful sense that goes with that. But that particular pain, the Buddha does not discourage. He says it's actually a pain to be cultivated. So that instead of just going back trying to find sensual pleasures, you say, okay, how do I get out of this particular pain? Then you start working on the path. So it's actually a way of motivating yourself. But it was not the kind of teacher who would say, well, you know, it feels painful to have a goal, so let's just not have goals. Or that Calvin Hobbes cartoon where Calvin makes, you know, the bottom part of a snowman, and he stops there and thinks, I think I'm going to be content with this. Doing the whole snowman is too much work. And Hobbes says, remind me to invest abroad. So those are some of the implications of what the Buddha said when he said this is a middle way and it is a path leading to the end of suffering, leading to unbinding, and that it is a path that goes someplace. Finally, in his last sermon, he said this was the only right way to get into awakening. It's important to understand the meaning of right here. I mean, he's talking in pragmatic terms. It works. And other paths don't work. The analogies he gives, my favorite one is the one where he says, some paths are like twisting the horn of a cow to get milk. And he doesn't say this, but not only are you not getting milk, but you're also harassing the cow. You know? Whereas the right way is to pull on the udder, and that way you get milk. So there's a right and wrong way of getting milk, and just the same way there's a right and wrong way of trying to put an end to suffering. So it's right not simply because the Buddha said it was right, because he's right because he's found that this is what works. And the things that deviate from this just would not work at all. Again, you sometimes hear people say that when you give up on effort, because effort is part of suffering. And that's like saying, okay, you can stop twisting the horn of the cow. And okay, you're fine. You find that, yes, not twisting the horn of the cow is actually nicer than twisting the horn of the cow. But you still don't get the milk. There's an effort that has to go into getting the milk. So that effort would be the effort of the right factors of the path. So if you have any questions on that, what have we talked about so far? I'm hoping for you to fill up the weekend with questions, okay? I'll put on my glasses so I can see you. Right there. Yes. Wait for the microphone to travel to you.
It's the distinction between suffering related to the Four Noble Truths mm-hmm. and suffering related to the Three Perceptions. Mm-hmm. Are they both experienced as suffering?
The second one is experienced as suffering because of the first.
Could you say more?
In other words, if you're clinging to things that change, then you're going to suffer. If you're not clinging to them, they can change and you don't suffer at all. And this is a case where I think that translating dukkha as stress might be valuable. There's kind of a stress inherent in anything that's caused. But does that stress necessarily have to place itself as a burden on your mind? And it becomes a burden on your heart or mind only when you're clinging to it. Okay, let's move on. Before you start the path, the Buddha said there are certain preliminary factors that go into as a kind of a foundation for the practice. We'll be looking at some of the passages in a minute, but I first wanted to go through them. It's kind of a general introduction. And basically, internally, the Buddha said that there are these factors: truthfulness, heedfulness, the ability to be observant, sangvega, which is a sense of dismay over how your life seems meaningless, or life in general seems meaningless, and then finally, appropriate attention. First, with truthfulness and the ability to be observant. There's one passage where the Buddha says, bring me someone who is no deceiver and who is observant, and I'll teach the Dharma to that person. So those are the two prerequisites. He wanted you to be a truthful person. In other words, you do something that's wrong, you're willing to admit it. You don't hide it from yourself. You don't hide it from other people. Because if you hide it from other people, you end up hiding it from yourself as well. And then when you hide things from yourself, then there's no way that you're going to be able to look into the mind to see what am I doing that's causing suffering. And to detect, actually to admit the fact that there is suffering there and that you're responsible for it. And the ability to be observant, the Buddha couldn't teach you everything. As my teacher, John Fuang, used to say, you can't expect your teacher to hand everything to you on the platter because you're going to have to develop your own discernment. And so your ability to observe your own actions is going to be an important part of the path. This is why in the forest tradition, a lot of the training is in assigning duties to the student, but not explaining everything. Letting the student observe things on his or her own. Give you an example. John Fuang told me that I had to build a hut for dyeing robes one time. We actually came to the States one time, and he noticed that my father was a carpenter. We got back to and he was one of those carpenters who chased me out of the shop all the time, so I never learned anything as a kid. And so he came back, he said, okay, the father's a carpenter, the son should be a carpenter. Build a hut. Without explaining. I knew nothing about it. I had to go out and sort of check in how are the roofs put together and how is this put together and that. And I was able to build the hut, but with very little input from him, let's put it that way. But as he said, it's useful to have that kind of challenge presented to you on practical terms, because then you learn to develop the same attitude in your own meditation. One, learning to recognize when a problem has come up, and then also use your ingenuity to figure out how to solve it. As his attendant, it was a while before I was actually allowed to be his attendant. And prior to that time, I would try to help around and arrange things in his hut. And if I arranged things in the wrong places, he'd just pick them up and throw them. He said, that's not the place. He wouldn't tell me what the place was. So I'd have to kind of look around and when he wasn't looking to see where things belonged. But that's an attitude that then is supposed to translate into your practice. Heedfulness is the realization that there are dangers out there, and the dangers can either be exacerbated or avoided by your actions. So it's not just there's danger and you just get scared by the fact. You say, okay, there's a danger, but here's how there's ways to avoid it. And if you act carefully, you can avoid it. If you act careless way, you're going to get into trouble. So that principle is also basic to the path. The quality of sangvega. This is the quality the Buddha himself said he felt when he looked at life, and he said he compared it to a dwindling stream in which fish were fighting each other for the last drop of water. It's like the salmon coming up the streams here in British Columbia. We saw that one year, and it was pretty dismaying. They're just struggling over the dead fish to get to that last little bit of water. In the meantime, the bears are on either side of the stream ready to scoop them up. And this was after they passed through the beach, where the birds were ready to pick out their eyes. And then you say, oh my gosh, this is life. Yeah. That's sangvega. And then appropriate attention is the ability to see what you're doing, where it's skillful, where it's not skillful. And look at things in that terms, in those terms. And when there's a problem, you reflect back, okay, what am I doing to exacerbate the problem? Instead of placing the blame on things out there, it's, okay, what am I doing that's bringing the problem on? And what can I do to change my activity? So these are all the preliminary internal factors that go into the practice of the path. Truthfulness, heedfulness, the ability to be observant, sangwega, and appropriate attention. Appropriate attention in particular is going to translate into right view as we get into the factors of the path itself. As for the external factor, the Buddha said that the primary one is admirable friendship. In other words, having admirable friends, admirable people as friends, and also trying to imitate their good qualities. So there's these two aspects to admirable friendship, is the people you're associating with and your willingness to try to mold your behavior in accordance with theirs. The basic lessons that you're going to learn from them are generosity, virtue, conviction, and discernment. Generosity means the willingness to give not only of your material wealth, but also of your time, your knowledge, your energy, your forgiveness. And one of the prime lessons in generosity that the Buddha gave was that to be really virtuous, generosity has to be voluntary, which is one of the reasons why monks are not allowed to tell you where to give things. If someone comes to a monk and says, where should something be given? You say, we're supposed to say, where you feel inspired or where you feel be well used. Several years back, someone came to me. His mother was going to be giving a $2 million donation to a Dharma center, and she was trying to decide whether to give to our monastery or someplace else. And so he said, what should I tell her? And I said, tell her to give where she feels inspired and the money would be well used. And then it went to the other place. But I still had my virtue. Okay? But there is, in the Buddhist sense of generosity, and the Buddha never gave Dana talks, One. There was never a suggested donation. It was always for free. And the reason for that is that the Buddha is trying to teach you that when he teaches you karma, he's teaching that you do have freedom of choice. And when you think about it, when is your first real experience of freedom of choice? When you're a child, it's when you give a voluntary gift. And it's not because it's Christmas, it's not somebody's birthday, but you felt just out of the goodness of your heart, you wanted to share something. And he's pointing to that. He said, that's karma. That's good karma. For most of us, when we first learn about karma, we say, oh my gosh, all those things I did in the past I thought I was going to get away with, I'm not going to get away with. And it's kind of the oh shit moment. The Buddha didn't teach karma that way. He said it's because of the principles of karma that generosity has value and that gratitude has value. In other words, if we have freedom of choice, if other people have freedom of choice as well. The fact that they do good to us means that we should be grateful to them. It's not that they had to do that or that we were entitled to their goodness. They went out of the goodness of their heart, made an extra effort. And so we have to appreciate that fact. And so the way the Buddha teaches karma means that it's generosity and gratitude actually have meaning. Virtue is sticking with the precepts. No killing, no stealing, no illicit sex, no lying, no taking of alcohol. It's interesting in the Buddha's analysis of these five precepts, he says, if you break the five precepts, you're harming yourself. If you get other people to break the precepts, you're harming them. And we usually think, you kill somebody, you're harming them, but he says, no, you're actually killing yourself. It's when you get them to kill, that's when you're harming them. I'm currently reading a book on the French Revolution, the trial of Marie Antoinette, and seeing what happens to people in the revolution. That it's out of fear or out of laziness that they kind of go along with all the violence. And then in many of the cases, in this particular case, the guy goes down the list of the people who judged Marie Antoinette, the people who were her accusers, the people who were on the jury, and almost all of them came to a bad end. But they were doing it basically at that time, they were passing judgment on her to save their skin. When you try to save your skin by killing somebody else, you're opening yourself up to all kinds of bad karma. And it's going to come back and get you. So getting other people to say, okay, you passed judgment on her. It was pretty much a done deal even before the trial started. Okay, get her executed. Okay, you're telling that person, okay, commit bad karma. Take on some bad karma for me. And that's harming that person. Yeah. That's virtue. Conviction. In Buddhism, conviction is primarily conviction in the Buddha's awakening, that he really did gain awakening through his own efforts. And in having conviction in that, you create a sense of the world which is different from, say, a sense of a world where no one has ever done that. You can compare this to the traditional account. You know, the Buddha went under the Bodhi tree and, you know, got his mind into concentration after he'd gone through all those austerities, was able to get into concentration, was able to solve the problem of suffering on his own. Have a little aside here. There's a Thai legend that goes in with the awakening of the Buddha. There was a king back in the 16th century. His name was Narlesuan. It's kind of a long story, but the short version of the story is that the Burmese attacked, and Narlesuan decided, okay, we've got to repel the Burmese. And so he got his troops together, and they were going to do a stealth attack at dawn on elephant back into the Burmese camp. And I love that idea, stealth attack on elephants. At any rate, Narlesuan apparently had the fastest elephant, and when the dust settled from rushing into the Burmese camp, he found himself the only person in the camp. The troops were way behind. And he saw the Burmese viceroy, and he challenged him to a duel. He said, okay, it's just you and me. If you're a man of honor, you know, we'll do it, you know, on elephant back jousting. And so they did, and Narlesuan was able to kill the Burmese viceroy just as his troops caught up with him. And so they routed the Burmese, sent the Burmese back. So Narlesuan gets back to the capital. He's furious with his generals because they didn't keep up with him. And he was going to execute a couple of them just to teach him a lesson. And so there was a senior monk outside of Ayutthaya who heard about this, and he called Narlesuan in. And he said, you remember the story of the Buddha's awakening, right? Yeah. Was anybody else around? No. And that's why we remember it. Because he did it all on his own. He's going down in history. He says, you're going to go down in history for having defeated the Burmese single-handedly. So the king goes back and forgives his generals. That's using pride. But that is, you know, here is a world. We live in a world, if you have conviction in the Buddha's awakening, we live in a world where someone is able to find an end to suffering through his own efforts. And it was through qualities that we all share. Man, woman, child, we all have the same kind of qualities the Buddha had in potential form, and that we can all do it ourselves. There are other versions of the Buddha's awakening story, which that's not the case. There's a Mahayana version where the Buddhas of the past take him away from the Bodhi tree, beam awakening basically into his head, and then he becomes the Buddha. So he had to depend on them. There's a Vajrayana version where even before he got to the Bodhi tree, he was having tantric sex back in the palace with his consort and gained awakening there, but then realized that a lot of people would not be inspired by that, so he goes out and under the Bodhi tree. And then there's the secular Buddhist version, in which there was no night of awakening. Anyhow, the Buddha just kind of thought and thought and thought and came to some nice conclusions, which he would like to share with us, saying that each of us has our own path and it depends on you to find your own path. These are all very different worlds created by these different stories. And also your sense of what you are capable as a person, this will give you a different sense of yourself. So it's up to you to choose which story that you find most inspiring, and then ask yourself, why do you find it inspiring? Is it out of qualities within yourself that you can trust or not? So conviction really is a matter of, conviction is also translated as faith, the word for conviction. And we tend to avoid the word faith when we're talking Buddhism because it's picked up some negative connotations for a lot of us from our other religious backgrounds. But you have to remember that conviction for Buddhism does not mean conviction in things that are not reasonable. There are things that are reasonable, but you can't really know until you put them into practice. So it's like working hypotheses. You can't really know that awakening is possible until you've actually tasted it yourself. But the prospect, the way it's explained, it makes sense. That's all conviction. Reason for the Buddha is actually part of conviction rather than a proof of anything. So this quality of conviction is, are you convinced that this is a good path to follow and that you have it within you to follow it? And so these are some of the lessons you would learn from an admirable friend. Also related to admirable friendship is the role of shame and honor in the Buddhist teachings. The Buddha actually talks quite highly of shame, But you have to realize that when he's talking about shame here, it's not the shame that's the opposite of pride, it's the shame that's the opposite of shamelessness. In other words, you have an admirable friend and you would be ashamed to think of your friend seeing you do something that was beneath the kind of behavior that you would actually like to have them think that you're up, that you're performing. And so that becomes a way of keeping your behavior under control. And it's based on high self-esteem rather than low self-esteem. So it's actually kind of a healthy form of shame that becomes part of the path, or one of the prerequisites for the path. So again, I'll stop there and ask if there are any questions on those topics, the preliminary factors, internal and external.
John, I was thinking of a term that I've heard in Buddhism of directed thought and evaluation, and a couple of things I just thought I would check. When you are giving meditation instructions and then you're coming out of it and saying, well, consider what went well and see if you can remember that and recreate it, or consider what didn't go well and maybe avoid that. Is that part of that same kind of directed thought and evaluation? And the other part was to examine where you've made a mistake and see if you can get corrected by someone who's wiser than you. Is that all in that realm?
They're all related, yeah. And if you're, when we're talking about direct thought and evaluation in the concentration itself, it's, you know, why you're doing something and watching, when I do this, what are the results I'm getting right now? Is it good? If it's not, then you adjust. When you're coming out, it's actually kind of a mindfulness. Reflect back and see if you can remember. Mm. It's kind of a retroactive evaluation. Mm-hmm. But it also then becomes, because these are the lessons that you're going to be carrying out of the meditation into the next meditation. Mm-hmm. And there are lessons to learn from your past meditations. So, but it's actually trying to your best to retroactively evaluate and then remember so you can carry it forward.
And what about in general in life when one might have made a mistake or said something that you regret then about? Is that part of that?
It's the same sort of thing, a kind of reflective, you know, analysis of things. Because when the Buddha says directed thought and evaluation, he says this is how you talk to yourself in all cases anyhow. Mm. And the basic sentence, you know, is creating a sentence in your mind. You have a topic and then you comment on it, or you ask a question about it, or you do something. Evaluate what's right or wrong about that. So once the mind is starting to talk to itself, it's already engaged in these things. Mm-hmm. Then the next question is, do you want to use that in a wise way or not? You know? Mm-hmm. And one wise way would be to reflect, okay, what have I done? How can I do it differently? And if I can't think of something, find somebody else. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to keep reinventing the Dharma wheel every time you make a mistake.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Teresa?
I'll ask a question while I have the microphone. Ajahn, I was under the impression that Samvega meant spiritual urgency. And the way you described it, it was more kind of a, I don't want to say a negative, but as something to be avoided, not...
No, it's a sense of dismay over seeing how...
How things are, how they
things
could
are,
be.
How things are, and it's just kind of general meaningless of life as is usually lived. And then a sense of urgency comes from that. But it also has to be coupled with what is called basada, which is a sense of confidence that there is a way out. And on its own, it can get depressing. And throughout the canon, except for the very late parts of the canon, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but it's a general sense that this is a bad situation that we're in, and you look around and it's the same for everybody else. And there's a kind of overwhelming sense of it's similar to the sense of awe about how just big the problem is, and that's how universal it is.
Thank you. So, Ajahn, my question is related to the answer you just gave, but I understand in Buddhism it's considered very fortunate to have had a human birth. Mm-hmm. But then the point is to get out of this cycle, and mm-hmm. sometimes I have trouble feeling the good fortune of mm-hmm. having had a human birth mm-hmm. when the point is to get out.
Okay, well, just think of it as you're close to the exit.
Perhaps I want something a little more inspiring.
Something more inspiring, okay. Okay. Well, you have the ability to listen and understand and practice the Dharma and do good for other people around you. We have that opportunity. You know, I think we're the only species that actually goes out and saves other species. You know, we've destroyed a lot of species, but there are some members who say, let's go save these animals. There's a certain nobility and the potential nobility in being a human being that you can actually look beyond your own personal gain and think of something larger, which you don't see in, you certainly don't see in the lower realms, where you see it very little. So there's a potential nobility in the human realm. But also just the fact that you're lucky that you're able to listen to the Dharma and understand it. And you have the opportunity to put it into practice. The responsibilities or the limitations of your body, not so much that you can't practice. Think of it in those terms. We have a couple cats at the monastery. And no matter how much you teach them the Dharma, they still go out and they still kill the squirrels. You know, it's just not getting through.
Thank you. I'm enjoying your thoughts about conviction in mm-hmm. particular, and it's conviction is something that always troubles me. And I guess I've been trying to think what my question is about the nature of conviction, and I think what it is something like this. It's something like whether there's a way to experience conviction that is somehow otherwise than attachment. Because conviction feels a bit like attachment to me.
You're going to have some clinging on the path to begin with. And so he asks us, what are some good things to hold on to in the meantime? And the principles you're being asked to hold on to are this. So you have the potential within you to find awakening, to put an end to suffering. That's a good thing to hold on to. And you're not holding on to, beat other people over the head. You're holding on to it because, okay, I need this in order to keep going. Because you look at all the other messages out there in the world, you see, they assume that true happiness is not possible. And they say, because of that, you're going to find satisfaction in buying our car, or whatever we're trying to sell to you. And you need something to resist that, because they do everything they can to make it as attractive as possible. So it's good to have that to hold on to. And it did. A couple of years back, they had that commercial for the BMW Chill. Did you ever see that? This guy comes up to the top of a parking garage, and there are all these very ordinary cars parked around, but there is his BMW. And he goes, like this. I mentioned that when I was in France a couple months back. It turned out somebody in the audience had a BMW. But that's the very, whatever it is they're trying to sell you. People are trying to say, look, forget about true happiness. Buy our product or do whatever. And the Buddha's saying no. And it's good to have something to hold on to. I have a potential within me. I don't need to find my satisfaction in buying things or in having a particular relationship or having a particular job. There's a potential with me that goes beyond that. And take it as a working hypothesis. And there's the image of the path as a raft, and you let go of the raft when you get to the other side. But as you're crossing the river, you hold on. Yes.
Thank you.
Finally.
It's that sense of pride that you just showed, I want a BMW or I want a BMW. You get that feeling of where it's suggested that when you sit to meditate, one of the things you can do is to look over your own ethical behavior and feel good about yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a kind of pride, too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'll see somebody do something, or I've thought about it. I think it's a common phrase in our cultures, is I wouldn't be caught dead doing that. Mm-hmm. And I felt good about myself. This is a pride, or is it, I think it's a good thing, but where is that line that you draw between the kind of pride in the car and pride in the possession of a good virtue?
Okay, when you start looking at other people's behavior and judging them, that's when your pride begins to develop teeth, fangs, So that's what you got to watch out for. I'm not trying to be better than other people, but I'm, this is, maybe back in the past, I used to do that kind of stuff, but now I don't do it anymore. I said, boy, I'm glad I'm not doing that anymore, and just leave it at that.
Right.
We're not here to compare ourselves with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is the essence of egoic pride, then.
Right. That,
when you compare yourself to someone else.
Right. That's where it becomes conceit, and that becomes a fetter.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
But
thank you.
Pride that gives you the sense, I'm capable of doing this, that's what you need. There's that great sutta where there's this nun who's really got it for Ananda. And so she sends word that she's sick and she wants to hear the Dharma. And so he comes into her room and he sizes up the situation pretty quickly. She's lying there on the bed with her robe over her head. And he starts out by saying that we practice to put an end to the need to feed, but we need to feed as part of the practice. We practice for the end of craving, but we need a certain craving to continue the practice, the desire for awakening. We're practicing for the end of conceit, but you need a certain amount of conceit to have your consent, the confidence that I'm capable of doing this. And then he finally says, we're practicing for the end of sexual intercourse, and there's no role for sexual intercourse.
Thank you. Thank you.
There's a question here in the front.
I have a question about a particular paragraph on page 4 of the notes. Mm-hmm. I'm not understanding the wording. It's the thing about wrong view. Mm-hmm. And he says, wrong view, there's nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. Does that mean that not to give offer or sacrifice is a result of wrong view? Or is it the nihilistic thing, there is nothing? Whatever you give, it is nothing. It doesn't really exist.
It's more the nihilistic view.
That was my question.
And I was going to get to that in a little bit later, but we'll get to it now.
Okay.
Back in the Buddha's time, prior to the Buddha's time, the Brahmins were always talking about how great it was to give to the Brahmins. And they even had funeral services that were conducted by the Brahmins, and there comes a point where the Brahmins say, now we're speaking in the voice of your dead ancestors. Give to the Brahmins, And then you give, and then it's part of the script, give more. So you can imagine, after a couple millennia of this, people were getting sick and tired. And the reaction was that really there's no virtue to giving at all. And the two reasons that were given were, one, people have no freedom of choice. So the fact that someone has given something to you doesn't mean anything at all. It was just the stars acting through them, or your own whatever, deserving whatever. So there's no merit in giving. Second reason was that people get annihilated at death anyhow, so whatever you do to help them just ends up in nothing. So why give? And so when the Buddha is basically saying that, when he gets into right view, he says there is giving, he's saying, okay, there's a virtue in giving that means, A, you do have freedom of choice, and two, death doesn't end in nothingness.
Right. Well, then that goes on to right view, I will tell you, is of two sorts. There is right view with effluence, mm-hmm. siding with merit, resulting in acquisitions. Mm-hmm. Number one. Could you give an example of what he means by an effluent? I know what effluent means.
That means there's still some defilement in there, but it's meritorious. The effluents are the things that, there's sensuality, there are views, there's ignorance. Those are effluents. So when you're getting started, even your good intentions are going to have some unskillful elements, but that doesn't mean to discount them. That's still, it's still, it's better than wrong view. In other words, this is the kind of view that will lead to rebirth, but a good rebirth.
Well, is that the acquisitions?
That's the acquisitions. You acquire a new rebirth.
Thanks.
Okay. Julie had a question.
Ajahn, at the very beginning, you were talking about the five clinging aggregates, and within the context of the subject. So it's just on my mind, and I thought if I'd ask you for clarification. What I'm wondering is it, what we're being asked to use are the aggregates in the development of the Noble Eightfold Path, and we're finding the right view, like it's, we can suffer from these clinging aggregates, but we're also using the aggregates in a skillful way in order to, that's the path. This is what we're fabricating.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Because as I said earlier, there is kind of a contradiction in the idea that you would use a fabricated path to get to the unfabricated. And there are actually schools of Buddhism that say, okay, we shouldn't have a path at all then. Because anything you might do would get in the way of the undone, you know, or the not doing. Whereas from the Buddhist point of view, and this fits in with non-linear causality, that you can use the factors of a particular system to bring it, take it apart. In other words, it's working within that particular system that you can actually dismantle it. And that's how you would get to the unfabricated, through using the fabricated. Because in his analysis, if anything is part of the causal system at all, it is both result and cause of something else. But if you want to get out, which is the unfabricated, that can't be the cause of anything at all. So you can't use the unfabricated to get to the unfabricated. You have to use fabricated things to deliver you to kind of the threshold. So yeah, we're going to be using the aggregates and our conceit and our craving and all the other quasi unskillful things, but we're learning how to do them in a more skillful way. So I had a student one time who was before he was a monk, he was a cook in Singapore, and first he worked for the Restaurant de France in the Meridian Hotel and learned French cooking. Then came to the monastery, decided he wanted to become a monk, and then went back and was going to earn some money for his parents, like a good Chinese son. And so the only job he could get was with the British Club. And he gets into the kitchen of the British Club and he's trying to show off his cooking skills, and they say, look, cool it. These people don't care. Until one night they'd had a fixed price dinner, and there was asparagus soup was on the menu, and apparently more people showed up for the dinner than they expected. And so they're running out of asparagus soup. And so he said, okay, everybody, out of the kitchen. And so he went into the trash can and got all the asparagus scrapings and things out of the trash can, kind of washed them off a little bit, made a nice sauce bechamel, and then made asparagus soup out of the trash, basically. And served it, and because the sauce was so good, everybody said, this is the best asparagus soup we've had here. So. And so basically, when you're following the path, you are taking stuff out of the trash and learning how to make something good out of it. So, any other questions?
Hello, Ajahn. It's a question about page 4, past excerpt number 8. We just talked about it a bit. Further down, it talks about the abandoning of wrong view and entering right view. And this is right effort. Now, does these three qualities, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness, run in circle around right view? So right view, right effort, right mindfulness, run in circle around right view. How can right view circle around itself?
Having right view about right view.
Okay.
Okay. In other words, recognizing that this is right view, that's wrong view. That's going to be part of right view.
Okay. When I read this, I was stuck on this for maybe like 20-25 minutes. Mm-hmm. I was bugged. And made me think, like, is this one of those feedback loops you've
It's kind of like
alluded?
A feedback loop, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then further down, there's the same pattern, right view, right effort, right mindfulness, and it runs around, run in circles around right resolve.
Mm-hmm. And all the factors of the path, basically.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's sort of almost equate right resolve and right view in as these three things are circling around something?
No, what he's saying is that these three things have to circle around every factor of the path, and once you have to recognize which is the right view, right resolve, etc., and which is wrong, that's one part of right view. And then remembering that, okay, the wrong version should be abandoned and the right version should be developed, that's the function of right mindfulness. And right effort is what actually tries to do it. Tries to abandon the wrong version and tries to develop the right version. So those three things are run around the whole path, which is getting into the next topic I was going to discuss. I was going to discuss one more topic, and then we're going to go through the readings. Okay, but it's part of it. Ready? Okay. One more topic, and then we'll try to get to some of the readings before lunch, but we'll see. There are basically two relationships or three relationships among the factors of the path. One is linear. You know, the list is you start with right view, and based on right view, you develop right resolve. Based on right resolve, you develop right speech. Based on right speech, you develop right effort, right action. From there, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. It just kind of follows step by step by step by step down the line. And the ways you can kind of think about it following that particular order. The second one is this one that Lex just brought up, which is that you have right view, right effort, right mindfulness circling around each of the factors as requisites for right concentration. In other words, recognizing that which is the right factor and which is the wrong version of the factor. Remembering, what do you do with the wrong version? You try to abandon it. What do you do with the right version? You try to develop it. That's the function of right mindfulness. And remember, mindfulness in the Buddhist teachings is not bare awareness and it's not choiceless awareness. It's remembering something that you want to apply to the present moment. Again, thinking back on the Buddha's analysis of your engagement with the present moment is proactive. And so he's saying these are the things you've got to remind yourself as you're engaging in your experience. And then right effort is what actually develops the right version of the factor and the wrong version of the factor. In both of these patterns, right view comes first, which means that it must inform each of the other factors. In other words, right resolve is going to be learning something from right view. Right speech will be learning something from right view. In particular, start with mundane right view, which is that your actions do have consequences. That means when you open your mouth to engage in speech, you have to remind yourself, okay, what kind of consequences come if I lie? What kind of consequences come if I don't lie? And so right view informs your right speech, similarly with right action. Right mindfulness, all the way down, they're all going to be informed by right view. It's like the map that tells you, okay, this is where you want to go, and this is the route to get there. But however, we'll see as we get into deeper into discussion, there are three levels of right view, and the path and all of these are developed as the path develops. In other words, once you've engaged in right speech, you've learned some things that are going to go back and kind of reinform your right view. Get it? It's kind of the knowledge that comes from actually engaging in things. For example, the discernment that comes, you've made up your mind you're not going to lie. A good friend comes up and she's wearing this ugly dress and she says, "How do I look?" How do you not lie? And at the same time, she obviously wants a compliment. So it requires that you develop your discernment. And as you... I'm not going to tell you what to say. It's going to vary from friend to friend. But then you've learned it. You've learned something important about how you use your discernment. And that goes back and that informs your right view and makes your right view more subtle. Because as the Buddha said, there's right view that comes from listening, you hear about it, and then there's the right view that comes from contemplating things. You think about what you've heard. And then the third is the right view that comes from actually practicing. And so as you put these things into practice, that's going to go back and inform your discernment. And then through the practice, your discernment gets more subtle, more appropriate for particular circumstances than it would have been just as a theory. And this gets into what is the third pattern, which is, if you look in the other qualities, lists of qualities that go into the path, discernment comes at the end, several of them, like in the terms of the five faculties or the five strengths. You've got conviction, and then it's persistence, and then it's mindfulness, then concentration, then the discernment comes. And the discernment makes the others firm. But the discernment is, here's the case where the discernment comes after. So what you find here, that even though right view has to inform the others are going to inform right view. So it's a back and forth, kind of a mutual relationship among the factors. So in all the cases, their specific insight comes into cause and effect of fabrication acts in the mind as you try to abandon right the wrong factors and develop the right factors. And then that knowledge about fabrication will go back into to inform right view. Here it's good to stop and talk about what the Buddha calls the three levels of fabrication that follow on ignorance. You've got bodily fabrication, which is the way you breathe. You've got verbal fabrication, direct to thought and evaluation, where you think about a topic and then you evaluate it, comment on it in your mind. And then third, mental fabrication is where you have feelings of pleasure, pain, neither pleasure nor pain, and perceptions. And these are the things that go into creating any mental state, particularly emotions. When a thought gets into your breath and has an effect on it, then it feels like an emotion. It's not just a thought anymore, it's become bodily. And so it's good to be able to analyze those states, but also say, well, I can create another state out of those same kinds of fabrication. That's a better state, which is what we do when we're following the path. For instance, you have a feeling of anger. You're going to be breathing in a certain way. You're going to be talking to yourself in a certain way. And there'll be these images going in your mind, enemy, whatever. The kind of things that they use in subliminal messages on TV. These kind of things just kind of flash into your mind very quickly that aggravate the anger. And then there'll be the feelings, of course, when you're not breathing right, you feel like, I've got to get this out of my system. And you say, wait a minute, if I get it out of my system by yelling at the person, that becomes my bad karma. And if I hold into it as it is, I've got to get bottled up, I'm going to get, it's going to come out like the thing at some point. So the Buddha is giving you another alternative, breathe in a different way. Breathe with knowledge, fabricate verbal fabrication with knowledge, mental fabrication with knowledge, and it turns an unskillful mental state into a skillful mental state. It's suffering when you do all these things in ignorance, which we tend to do anyhow, but if you can bring knowledge to these levels of fabrication, then you can learn how to do them more skillfully. And that's the kind of knowledge that comes through practice. So it's not just having right view about these things, but it's actually having hands-on experience. You're in the middle of an argument, and you, whoops, breathe calmly. A while back, I saw a scientific experiment that said that you can calm your mind down by breathing calmly. And people actually get grant money for this kind of thing. Okay, breathe calmly. So kind of get the physical side out of your system, and then ask yourself, how am I talking to myself about this? Is there a more skillful way to talk to myself about it? If all I can think about, this person did this and this person did that, and I say, wait a minute, what about the good things that person did? Or could I look at this from a different perspective? I've got my narrative that I'm bringing to the problem. Can I change the narrative? Still be a true narrative, but basically stitch things together in a different way, so that it's not aggravating the anger. And then you're going to ask yourself, what are the images that I'm holding in my mind? All too often, when we're feeling anger about something, we're up here on the judge's seat, and that other person's way down there, and we're not going to be touched by whatever judgment we pass. And the Buddha says, replace that with a different image. You're going through a desert. You're hot, trembling, tired, trembling with thirst. You come across a little footprint of a cow with a little bit of water in it. Now, you need the water, but you know that if you try to scoop it up, you're going to make it muddy, so you actually have to get down and slurp it out of the kettle. footprint. Now, it's not a very dignified position. And you certainly wouldn't want anybody to come along and take a picture of you at that point. But it's what you need. And so you remind yourself the next time you're angry at somebody and you feel it would be beneath my dignity to think good thoughts about this person. You say, you need it. Because if you can't see good in other people, what's going to promote, you know, encourage you to behave well in your own behavior toward them? There's that cartoon in the New Yorker, did I ever tell you about that one with the two lady poodles in the bar? You can tell they're lady poodles because they have, you know, mascara and lipstick. And they have little martinis in front of them. And they have this kind of mean look on their faces. And they're saying, they're all sons of bitches. Well, if everybody else is a son of a bitch, what are you, you know? So you have to look for the good in other people. You need their goodness. I could talk all day about my favorite New Yorker cartoons. Two couples are sitting in the living room. And the husband on one side is saying, of course it's had its ups and downs, but by and large, Margaret and I have found that the consumer experience to be a rewarding one. Enough. Okay, one more. This very dumpy looking guy is sitting in a bar. And there's this really cute little dog at the other end of the bar, making eyes at him. And she's saying, hey, good looking, got a leash? We could have some fun. Okay. So we're working on the path, and the relationship among the factors is going to be very complex. You have the linear version, which you just start with right view and work your way through. The second version, which Lex just pointed out, where you've got right view, right mindfulness, and right effort revolving around each of the factors as you practice. And then the third one, where the lessons you learned from doing the later ones are actually going to go back and train your right view so that it gets more precise and more more subtle and more to the point. We have to keep remembering that insight is not just noting things as they're happening. There's a value judgment involved. What's worth doing, what's not worth doing. And the lessons we learn through our actions are going to go back and train our discernment as to what is and what is not worth doing. Any questions on that before we look at the passages? Yes. Oh, where's the mic? Behind you.
Earlier on, you mentioned that shame is from high self-esteem, not low self-esteem.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Which isn't my experience of it.
There are two kinds of shame.
Oh, I see. Kay. But I'm wondering, when you were talking about changing your thinking about things, mm-hmm. can you change that kind of shame?
Yes. Well, you first cultivate the kind of self-confidence that comes from thinking about the implications of the Buddha's awakening, that I have it within me to do this. And the reason that I haven't been following this path is that I've been ignoring some good qualities that I had that I could develop. And then as you start working on the path and you begin to realize, okay, I'm actually more skillful than I used to be, that's how you develop higher and higher self-esteem. And then when you go back and you backslide, you say, I'd be ashamed to do that. I shouldn't be doing this. And that sense of shame around that picture. Because what is shame? It's the desire to look good in the eyes of other people. And you have to ask, so whose eyes do I want to look good in? And we say, well, I'd like to look good in the eyes of the noble ones. Or if the Buddha were around, he'd say, oh yeah, I admire this woman. That's the kind of shame. Those are the eyes that you want to look good in. And as for the people who's, you know, who have other opinions and other things, I don't really have to care about their opinions because I don't respect their opinions. So it means, you know, being very careful about whose eyes you want to look good in and whose standards you want to live up to.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's look at the passages then. Okay. The first one on page one. This is the very beginning of the Buddha's first sermon. These two are extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who's gone forth. Which two? That which is devoted to sensual pleasure in connection with sensuality. The word sensuality here means basically your fascination with thinking about sensual pleasures, planning sensual pleasures, reliving sensual pleasures. It's not the pleasures themselves are the problem, it's the sensual pleasure, the sensuality. It's the mind's fascination with fantasizing about these things. Like you can go to a dinner and it takes maybe half an hour to eat the dinner, but you can think about it for hours ahead of time and hours afterwards. And it's that pleasure that we take in thinking about these things over and over again. That's the sensuality here. And as most of us have learned, that our anticipations and our reliving of pleasant experiences tend to exaggerate things, so that we're pretty bad judges of what actually makes us happy. And I was reading about a positive psychologist, you know, the kind that studies ways people try to make themselves happy. And he would talk to people and interview them and say, okay, what are things that make you happy? And then they had some arrangement where I will call you up while you were doing this and ask you about it. And so he would call up these people in the midst of activities, some activities that they were doing that made them happy. And he said, okay, are you being happy? And said, not especially. But then he'd talk about it afterwards. Oh, yeah, it was really great. And he kept thinking to himself, why are people so stupid? And then he thought about himself. He was a mountain climber. And he realized that while he was on the mountain, he was miserable. But before and after, it was just great, you know. So it's something about our minds, that we're pretty bad judges of our own happiness. And it's the sensuality which is the problem. This fascination with thinking about how great this is going to be, how wonderful it's going to be, and then ignoring what the actual experience is like. So we're attached to sensuality. And he says this kind of pursuit of sensual pleasures through sensuality is base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable. And then the other unprofitable side is devoted to self-affliction, painful, ignoble, and unprofitable. Avoiding both of these streams, the middle way realized by the Tathagata, producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to stilling, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. And then he goes through and identifies that path as the Eightfold Noble Path. Is there anything in that passage that you wanted to discuss any further? Okay, second passage. What is this holy life? Again, it's the Eightfold Path. What are the fruits of the holy life? Stream entry, the fruit of one's returning, the fruit of non-returning, the fruit of arahantship. And what is the goal of the holy life? Whatever is the ending of passion, the ending of aversion, the ending of delusion. That's called the goal. So notice the path and the goal are two very different things. The fruits and the goal are things that are unfabricated, that will not change. Whereas the path itself is made out of fabrication. The word fabrication here is sometimes identified in the canon as intentions, because you have an intentional element in all of your engagement with sensory experience. But the goal is something that's outside of sensory experience. It is not. There's no intentional element there. You know, you may intend to get there, but once you're there, there's no intention. You don't have to use any intention to keep it going. It's something that is outside of causality. So it's not going to be touched by causal things. The next passage makes a similar point. It points out whatever dharmas may be fabricated or unfabricated, the dharma of dispassion, the subduing of intoxication, the elimination of thirst, the uprooting of attachment, the breaking of the round, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, the realization of unbinding. This is supreme. Because that's the goal. It's an unfabricated Whereas fabricated dharmas would be the Eightfold Path. That's the highest fabricated dharmas there are. In other words, this is the best thing you can put together through your intentions. Passage 4 is the explanation of the famous image of the raft, taking the raft across the flood. Okay, the great expanse of water stands for the fourfold flood, the flood of sensuality, becoming, views, and ignorance. Okay, sensuality we've already discussed as your fascination with thinking about sensual pleasures or planning for them. Becoming is the act of taking on an identity in a particular world of experience. And this can happen both on the large level, like we're all human beings in this level becoming. That's a kind of a, what they call a large becoming. And then, but in the mind, you also have these little becomings where you take on an identity, you have a little world of experience, you take on an identity there. You can start thinking about how much you want chocolate. And in every case, becoming starts with a desire. In case you have the desire for chocolate. And then in that particular becoming, the world that's relevant will be the world that's, you know, where you can find the chocolate. What are the obstacles to getting there right now? Only 10 more minutes and it's time for lunch. So I'll sit with the 10 minutes. And then as for yourself in that world, it's the self that's both going to produce or provide the desire. In other words, what do you have under your control that you can get with chocolate? Do you have enough money right now? Do you have a car to take you to the shop? Do you have some other way of getting there? If you don't have your own car, can you sweet-talk somebody into taking you there? All these things become part of you, you know, or the relative parts of you. And then there's the self as the consumer, i.e. the person who's going to be eating the chocolate and enjoying it. Now, those things together are your sense of self in that particular becoming. And then you may have another desire. You may get into an argument with somebody. You want to win the argument. Okay, you're at that point, the issues of chocolate go by the board. The money to buy the chocolate, the car to get to the store, those are no longer of interest to you. The world is the world of your argument, and your identity is the person who wants to win the argument. And so your sense of identity will change as it goes from becoming to becoming. And this happens in the course of the day many, many times. And the Buddha is saying that basically our craving for becoming in this way is going to be a cause of suffering. But the path also requires becoming. You become the meditator, you become the practitioner, and the world of practice suddenly becomes the relevant world. So we're trying to get, eventually, however, we're trying to get beyond the need for becoming. Views would be any view that you would hold to that, just for the sake of holding to the view. And then ignorance would be ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. But what is the problem of suffering? What is its cause? How do you put an end to it? And what the end would be? Okay, that's the flood you're trying to get over. The near shore that you're trying to get away from stands for self-identity. In other words, creating a sense of yourself either as equal to the aggregates or as owning the aggregates or as being inside the aggregates or having the aggregates inside you. However you want to create a sense of self with reference to those aggregates of form, feeling, perception, fabrication, and consciousness. That's the near shore that you want to get away from. The far shore is unbinding. The raft stands for the Noble Eightfold Path. And as you hold on and make an effort with your hands and feet, that stands for the arousing of persistence or the arousing of your energy to practice the path. So I was saying earlier, when you're crossing across the flood, you need to hold on to the raft. So there would be an element of holding on. An element of attachment. It's only when you get to the other side that you realize, okay, this raft has held me, done a lot for me, but I'm not going to carry it around anymore because I don't need it. I've reached safety. Any questions on that image or any of the terms in that passage? Lex? Is there?
I want to talk about the flood of sensuality, mm-hmm. Passage 4. Mm-hmm. Something I'm working on is internal idle chatter mm-hmm. in my head when mm-hmm. I sub-vocalize all sorts of thinking and I'm thinking. And I know, like, okay, well, this is useless, you know, and so on. This internal chatter that we have, like, I'm trying to see it in terms of fascination, like mm-hmm. something that I keep doing, mm-hmm. and it's a form of wrong speech. It's not vocalized, but it's mm-hmm. it's mental. It mm-hmm. goes on and off. Mm-hmm. That's the one I'm working on. Idle chatter, and I'd like to somehow like connect it. Like, is it a sensuality that thinking about thinking, or
well, it's kind of a fascination with the ability to just put together words. And I wouldn't say that's necessary sensualities per se. It's just that it's one of your talents as a human being. Hey, I can make sentences. You know. And they don't have to mean anything, and they don't have to be, you know, just I can just keep producing these sentences. You know, as little children, it was quite an accomplishment to be able to do that. But then you find you've got this talent that you just do for this, because you have the talent, I can do this.
Mm-hmm. It looks like I like the sound of my own thinking, and it's useless, and I'd like to get rid of that, you know, and move on to more productive things.
Okay, well, just ask yourself, what would be something useful to think about right now? You don't say, stop thinking. If you tell yourself to stop thinking per se, there's going to be resistance. Mm-hmm. So what would be actually a useful thing to think about right now? I've got this ability, but what am I going to do with it?
Absolutely. It's a good one. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, hey, you can think in French. I've been trying for years, you know.
Say about that.
Okay. Well, think useful thoughts in French, okay?
It's strange, but French is my first language, but English is dominant in the sense that my thinking is formed in English, mm-hmm. even if it's faulty and mm-hmm. grammatical.
Well, you worked so hard to be able to do that, right? To develop a second language that you can think in, right? And now that ability has taken over.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you have to say, okay, now I want to get a rein on this. Okay, I want to think things that are useful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The good thing, at least, is I'm somewhat quick at noticing, okay, well, this is useless.
Mm-hmm. And well, just ask yourself, what would be a useful thing to replace it with?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Questions over here?
What?
Oh, there's a question back here. Oh, come on.
I've just, like in reading about thoughts, I read that they're not us, that they're just sort of, they don't belong to me, mm-hmm. that they're just out there and they come into my mind. So how does that relate to...
We have two kinds of thinking. Some are the results of past karma. And those are things that just kind of come to your mind. Because in the past, it's related to blessing, you were able to develop this ability. And you used to think about these things, and that pattern of thinking is just going to keep coming back based on your past karma. And then there's present karma thinking, where I think, what am I going to do with this? And for the time being, think of that as yours, okay? I'm responsible for what I'm thinking about right now and how I'm handling this stuff that's coming in from the past. The whole thing about self and not self, we can get that into that after the lunch break, but you will be developing a certain kind of self as part of the path, which you will then let go at the very end. So in the meantime, you be the self. Says, okay, when something comes up, I'm going to be the person who decides whether this is useful or not. I'm going to try to do this well. And that's a good self to encourage. Ajahn Sawat used to like to notice, he said, you know, the Buddha says everything is not self, not self. But then he says, I am the owner of my actions. So, okay, own your present actions, okay, for the time being. As for the other things, John Lee has a great image. He says, you know, you've got these worms in your body, you've got germs in your body. maybe they have thoughts. And they're, you know, especially the germs, as they go through the blood in your brain, they just kind of leave a thought behind and then they Okay, one more question and then we break.
Ajahn, you mentioned not too long ago about like using the example of anger. Mm-hmm. You've got like this self-talk going on. So I just wanted to kind of expand on what was said about like useless thoughts coming into your mind. Mm-hmm. And then like beyond that, like angry thoughts when a situation arises. And it sounded like, again here, you were talking about taking a really active approach to those kind of thoughts when they arise, or mm-hmm. even random thoughts that arise, you know, like annoyance at the noise the neighbor's making or something mm-hmm. like that. So taking that opportunity to actually work with those thoughts that are coming into your mind, and I just wondered if you could speak to that just a little bit more.
Okay, well, there are different ways you can engage with unskillful thinking coming in, and I mean one of them is just to say I'm just not going to get involved. But there's the other one. Before you do that one, you say, can I correct this? Like, you know, you're talking to yourself about the noise the neighbors are making, and think about a John Cha's example. He says that the noise is not disturbing you, you're disturbing the noise, you know. The noise is just doing its thing and you're the one that's making this commentary on it. And you say, well, I don't have to get involved with that. And yeah, just and think that much, and it helps lessen the problem.
Yeah, because it's a very well-worn pathway now.
Yes, uh-huh. And so you've got it. And when it's a well-worn pathway, you've got to learn how to go across the ruts so you're not falling back into it over and over and over again. But, I mean, when the Buddha was teaching meditation to his son, he starts out by saying, make your mind like earth. You know, people spit on the earth, they throw garbage on the earth, and earth doesn't react. But then he goes on to teach breath meditation. It's a very proactive involvement in how you deal with the breath, how you're going to breathe, making up your mind you're going to breathe in certain ways to encourage certain mind states. So the non-reactivity is not the whole of the practice. It's your basic place you can step back to and say, okay, what I did just now, is that skillful or not? You're going to get kind of a more objective perspective on what you've been doing. And then if it's not skillful, what would be the most skillful thing to do with it now? Or if it is skillful, how do I encourage it? Or if I've been tired of thinking skillful thoughts, maybe I can get my mind in concentration and be quiet for a while.
Right, so going beyond mere observation to
right,
a more
right,
active approach.
Right, yeah. Because the observation is just the basic kind of mindfulness 1.0, you know.
Yeah.
And then you move on to 2.0, and then there's more to be done.
Thank you.
Okay, the time has come for the lunch. So we'll break right there, and we'll come back and continue our discussion this afternoon at 1:15.